Good morning and welcome to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak here with Tim Henney. And today in the program, we'll speak first with Matthew Kohut. He's the author, along with John Neffinger, of the book Compelling People, Hidden Qualities That Make Us Influential. When people size you up, what do they see? Drawing on cutting-edge social science, as well as their own work with Fortune 500 executives, members of Congress, and Nobel Prize winners, these two reveal the basic framework we all use to judge each other. As it turns out, strength and warmth are the two qualities that these character judgments revolve around. Stay tuned for that interesting conversation.
Good morning, Lynn. Then we'll speak about How to Up Your ACT Score in a fun, informative book written by our guest Chris Arp, along with three kids who got perfect scores. And that reminds me, a Park City resident, Zach Loffer, just turned out a perfect score in the ACT. Congratulations, Zach.
Yeah.
The book is called Up Your Score ACT. It's the underground guide and how to outsmart the ACT. And really, to have fun doing it, or so the book makes it sound. This is The Mountain Life on KPCW. Stay tuned.
Promontory and our foundation are loyal supporters of KPCW. The Promontory Foundation gives to local Park City nonprofit organizations that make this such a unique place to live. Promontory is a four-season, second-home community offering trail sports, a kids' clubhouse, and a private Deer Valley ski lodge for our members. For more information, promontoryclub.com.
Dr. Hart and Dr. Adams, a Park City specialty group, are board-certified surgeons who help locally with minimally invasive procedures to screen, diagnose, and treat hernias. An experienced and comfortable surgery option closer to your loved ones and friends is available locally for you. Visit them online at parkcityspecialty.com or call today at 435-658-7400. Intermountain Healthcare is a nonprofit organization.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak here with my co-host Tim Henney. Well, when people size you up, what do you think they see? And what is the basic framework we all use to judge each other? According to John Neffinger and our next guest, Matt Kohut, they're co-authors of Compelling People. These character judgments revolve around two qualities: strength, the root of respect, and warmth, the root of affection. The ability to project both strength and warmth at once is rare. So rare, in fact, that we celebrate, elevate, and envy those few people who can manage it. In the book Compelling People, Neffinger and Kohut detail all the subtle but critical signals that make some people irresistibly engaging and others forgettable. And they show us not only how to appear both strong and warm, but how to internalize the attitudes that will earn you both respect and affection. And co-author Matt Kohut is joining us by phone.
Great. Oh, thanks so much for having me.
Well, first of all, you know, your message is simple. It's we need to exude strength and warmth to be compelling people. But on the other hand, it's very complex as you read into the book and you talk about which way your, you know, palms are going to face, you know, forward or backward, and the slight tilt of your head.
Well, that's right. You know, there's a lot to this, and yet the basic ideas are things that we're kind of aware of on the periphery of our everyday life. We're just not thinking about it so much. And, you know, one way to think about this, you know, as far as it being something that makes you self-conscious, is that when you learn how to do anything that's a new skill, whether it's, you know, hitting a golf ball or learning to play the guitar or anything, there's a certain period where trying on new skills feels a little uncomfortable, and then it becomes second nature. Even learning to drive is the same thing. And, you know, so when you think about how you're changing the way you're presenting yourself to people, there can be some of that consciousness at the beginning or even self-consciousness, but it's completely possible to integrate these skills so that they become unconscious, and that's really where the good stuff happens.
Right. So, you know, so often we don't even know what it is about ourselves that we're exuding, what, you know, even emotions that we don't know we're having are sort of surfacing and making themselves apparent to our audience. But can we really revolutionize what we do? Is it really something we can help?
Well, you know, there's stuff that all of us are able to do. The question is, where do you begin from? Everyone is a little different. And as you mentioned, the basic ingredients here are strength and warmth. And each of us has a balance of these qualities that's somewhat different. And so someone may be a little more strong than warm. Another person may be a little more warm than strong. And then the question is, to what extent, with some awareness of how you begin, can you turn those knobs a little bit to maybe be a little bit more of the thing that you lack?
Matt, it's interesting because just the other day I read a piece about power versus empathy. And there are these studies that have shown that people, the greater amount of power people have, the less amount of empathy they seem to have for the general populace. And I think it was relating to politics and industry. And in your book, you talk about strength and warmth, and they seem very similar. And you say that there's direct tension between strength and warmth, just as this other article talked about tension between power and empathy. Can you describe that to us?
Yeah, I saw that as well, and it just rang a bell with me because it really is hitting on this fundamental tension that we describe in the book. It turns out that, you know, if you're flexing a certain set of muscles, you know, such as, you know, things that make you strong, the warm ones can get rusty. And, you know, that, I mean, that's kind of oversimplifying as far as the power and empathy findings. But the basic idea here is that the more you do one of these things, the harder it can seem to do the other. At least that's what some of the research is showing. And this has also been shown with relation to wealth as opposed to power. So it is very much something that we see in real life, sort of on a day-to-day basis. And so it's all that much more important for us just to be aware of this tension between these two qualities and understand that the one that we embody most means that the other one has to be actively projected.
And you talked about the balance between the two, and now you're talking about the one that we sort of naturally default into and project the most. Is that hardwired, or is that something that we learn through our upbringing?
I think it's a little bit of both, quite honestly. You know, there's a little bit of nature and nurture here. I mean, when you look at people who are public figures, politicians are easy to pick on for this because we see so much of them. People start out with a, you know, something that's maybe their hardwired default, you know, they're a little stronger or they're a little warmer, but they can learn the abilities, you know, they can learn to project the other thing they have. So I think that some of it's what you grow up around, some of it's just the way you are. And really the fun part begins when you start to get a sense of that self-awareness of what you're putting out to other people and then think about how you might want to adjust that depending on what you're trying to accomplish.
And Matt, I'm always fascinated by the research that goes into these books, and you refer to it as cutting-edge social science research. Can you describe some of those elements that you relied upon and incorporated into your book?
Sure. Well, this big picture finding about the role that strength and warmth play in our perceptions of each other, just when we size each other up, that's relatively new work. I mean, it has a pedigree in social science going back several years, but as far as it being something that's gotten the attention it deserves, it hasn't quite happened yet. I mean, part of what we're hoping the book will do is just make people more aware that this research exists. And, you know, then we go into lots of other research that's kind of coming out almost by the day about the different dynamics that you see as far as the way these things manifest themselves in different situations and with people, you know, of different genders and different ethnicities. So it gets the research pile gets bigger and bigger on a day-to-day basis. And this book's not even anywhere close to the last word on this. This is very much a moving target, but it is where we are or where we were when we finished writing it last fall.
So, Matt, I'm wondering, you know, if you look at strength and warmth, I have a fair idea why I might feel someone is compelling for exhibiting strength and warmth. But what do you find, and what have you found that might surprise us about those two qualities?
Well, you know, the one thing that's interesting is that warmth looks different in different settings. So if you think about, oh, I don't know, let's take a Wall Street trading situation and a kindergarten class to take two very different dynamics, warmth means something different in one than the other. And warmth really means you share the concerns or interests of the people around you or the people you're dealing with. And so you show that very differently in different situations. And that was something that was a surprise to us. I mean, warmth is not just about sort of being smiley and gregarious and holding the door for people. It's really about being on the same team as them and being somebody who wants what they want. And so that looks very different in different contexts. And that's one of the trickiest things about understanding this and explaining to people is that it's not one-size-fits-all thing. All of this stuff is very much based on the context in which you find yourself.
Right. Okay. So at one point in the book, you describe a scene that we've all been privy to. It's walking into the party before the friends who you're supposed to come with arrive, which I think most of us don't like to be in that situation because we feel some security in walking in with our friends, right? So you describe these four people that the person encounters, you know, one who answers the door, and, you know, I think it's the bartender and another couple people. And maybe you can just go through, I mean, we've all felt it, what it feels to feel like we're not accepted, or we're not meeting people who are both strong and warm. We're meeting people who are probably insecure themselves and lacking confidence.
Yeah, well, you know, it's funny because we, you know, that scene was sort of an opportunity to introduce the kind of extremes that you see of high strength and low warmth and high warmth and low strength. And we sort of used the characters at this cocktail party to embody the four combinations there. And so the person that you are walking in knowing nobody was really just a fly on the wall, and that said it. But yeah, you're absolutely right. That's a situation that's pretty uncomfortable for most of us. And the thing to keep in mind is that if you're walking into a social setting and you're looking to connect with people, the thing that you might want to try doing, and, you know, this is harder for some people than others because some people are just a little more naturally shy than others, is find something that you can, you know, that shows that you have some common ground with a person. I mean, that sounds really simple and straightforward, but the kinds of ways you show that you have common ground are connecting emotionally. So it's not so much about, you went to that high school, I went to that high school too. Well, that can work in some cases, but more likely the thing that's going to connect you to somebody is feeling the same way they felt about something, as opposed to having some sort of a more superficial thing in common with them, like having, you know, worked at the same place at some point in your careers, or having something that's more of a resume kind of a thing. It's having a shared feeling that connects you with people most quickly in that kind of a setting.
Matt, I'm a big fan of dogs, and I read something a long time ago that said you should live your life more like a dog lives their lives. You know, always greet people that you love with a smile and wagging your tail, always. And in your book, you go into what dogs teach us about nonverbal communication. Can you walk us through that?
Sure. We have this little example in the book about how when my dog was a puppy, I used to yawn to get her to yawn. And, you know, dogs will mirror our behavior in a lot of ways, and the yawning one is a very simple thing to do if you want to see how this works. But dogs will mirror a lot of our body language. I mean, think about if you cock your head at a puppy, the puppy will cock its head back at you. And dogs can give us a sense of how this mirroring behavior works. And once you're aware of that, you also see, and it's an empathetic behavior. It's it's a way of showing that you're in sync with somebody, or in this case, some being. And when you're aware of that in a social setting, you'll notice it too. You know, think about if you're having lunch with a friend and the friend leans in to tell you something and you lean in to hear them. You're not just leaning in because that friend's whispering. You're leaning in because you just naturally do this with each other. And dogs are, you know, masters of that behavior because they want to please us.
And the follow-up right next to that is the most powerful phrase in politics. And then also that, you know, what really works for deciding who we vote for in an election. Politics are obviously a place where this strength resides, and politicians have to build in some warmth, whether they come to that naturally or whether they have to develop it. So what is the most powerful phrase in politics, and how does that relate to warmth?
Well, the phrase we're referring to there is something we call common sense. And yes, it's that simple, common sense. Everyone wants to be the common sense candidate. And common sense refers to warmth because people who have common sense, they have something in common with us, actually. And, you know, it is a sense, and it's a gut sense, and it's also a cognitive sense, an intellectual sense about the way the world is. And you either get it or you don't. And there's always this race among political candidates every 4 years running for president to be the candidate who embodies common sense or who is the candidate of common sense. And, you know, this has a long and pedigreed history in our political discourse that common sense has a resonance as the thing that a candidate wants to have. Well, we don't want our presidents to be the smartest person in the room. We want them to be the person of the people, the common sense person.
If you're just joining us, our guest is Matt Kohut. He's the co-author of the book Compelling People, The Hidden Qualities That Make Us Influential. You know, I'm wondering, you and your co-writer, John Neffinger, you're partners in KNP Communications, and one of the things you do is to prepare speakers for these high-powered audiences. And I found that interesting because if you have made it as a speaker to the point where you're speaking to a high-powered audience, you already are doing a lot right. But when you coach these people, what are you finding that they're doing wrong? And I suppose it all relates back to strength and warmth.
It does, in fact, yeah. Well, you know, oftentimes the reason somebody's in that kind of a situation is because they've accomplished something terrific. You know, they've written a book, or they are in some way in a position of authority or power because of their deeds. But they may not necessarily be projecting the requisite warmth to connect with an audience. I mean, that's a sort of relatively simple example where, you know, you'll see people who have a lot of great ideas, but they haven't thought about conveying them with enough warmth to connect with audiences and or find a way to get the audience engaged with the idea at that front so that their ears open up and they really dig into the idea with them.
I always wonder, when you're hearing a speaker speak or you're in the audience, very often you'll hear someone saying all the right words and saying all the right things, and yet you just can't pay attention to what they're saying. You just lose your focus on what they're saying. I suppose, does that go back to what you're talking about?
It does, and it goes to another thing often, too. And this is where the words have to line up with the way you're saying it. And that means they have to line up with what people are seeing visually in terms of your posture and your gestures and your body language. And it also has to align with the tone in your voice, the emotion that you're putting across. You know, most of what we get about how people are feeling comes across through those visual and tone of voice channels rather than the words themselves. Now, that's not to say the words don't matter. They matter tremendously, as any politician who's flubbed on the public stage can tell you. But the emotion that people are feeling will be apparent in the visual and in the tone of voice more than in the words. If you turn it off the mute on your TV, you can still tell what people are feeling often just by watching them. And that's a really important thing. And when those three things are working together, that's what gets you paying attention to people, is when all three channels, the words, the tone of voice, and the visual are all in sync. That's when you're on. And when there's that disconnect, that might be when you're tuning out or just a little uncomfortable about what you're seeing.
So, Matt, you talk about analyzing these elements like speech, gesture, and dress, which, again, gets back to that kind of common sense thing. A lot of us have kind of grown up with certain standards if we want to be accepted, if we want to compel people. We sort of look how we speak, how we dress, and the gestures that we make. But you also delve into some of the taboos like race and gender, and that's a little different story.
Yeah, it is. And we felt like it was important to start with that stuff because in the book we call it the hand you're dealt. And all of us are born with different attributes, including race and gender. And, you know, it's important to understand the effect that those things have on how someone perceives you before you then want to think about what kinds of things you might want to do to sort of turn the knobs on your own personal strength and warmth.
And you don't just stop there. I mean, a lot of this is about business and our interactions with people in business, but you also go into personal relationships. And of course, we've got to talk about love. And you know, again, it goes back to that, the first meeting. And you talk for a while about the qualities within a smile.
Right. You know, one of the funny things that we learned, you know, there were all these surprising things in the research, and one of the interesting things there was this idea that guys who smile a lot when they're out on a date they may not be the guys who get who get the girl, so to speak, in the sense that the smiling guy can sometimes seem too eager to please. And there's this tension there that, you know, I mean, this is the font of romantic comedies all over. But the research bears it out. The big golden retriever smile, the happy guy, that's not always the most winning strategy if a guy is trying to woo a woman.
Well, Matt, is that because of an element of authenticity? Is that what that goes to? Putting on a facade instead of presenting yourself authentically?
Well, you know, it could certainly be part of it, and you know, it also just seems that when you think about the gender roles here, the presumption, and these are rebuttable presumptions with all of us, but the presumption is that men are strong and not so warm, and that women are warm and not so strong. That's what the research shows us. And again, these are rebuttable presumptions, and stereotypes shift over time. So, you know, what we feel in 2013 won't be the case 10 years from now. But those are sort of the basic underlying dynamics in the research. And so when men are showing a lot of warmth in that first impression that's going a little bit against type there, it can sometimes raise an eyebrow and say, huh, well, I don't see the strength I'm looking for there. That can explain why this might be happening.
Right. And that is a really interesting conversation in and of itself, with gender roles sort of shifting and changing and, you know, women in these positions of power, and all day long they're being strong at work. And then they come home and, well, it's time to be a little more warm. And the same with men. I mean, men are confused about their roles because they're typically strong, and we as women want them to be strong. We want a strong man, but then they're also told that they're supposed to be soft and warm, and wow, it's confusing.
It is, and like I said, it is a moving target, and I think, you know, if we looked at the stereotypes of the genders 30 years ago, they would be pretty different, and they're going to continue to evolve, and I think it'll probably get more complicated, not less, at this point.
Matt, did men or women make those transitions from strength and warmth better than one or the other that Lynn just, you know, kind of laid out?
Well, you know, the trick is, I mean, it's still, no surprise to women listeners here, it's still a very unlevel playing field. Particularly in the workplace, and the problem that women will encounter is that if women are presumed warm, again, this is just what the research shows, then when they do show that strength in the workplace, then their warmth sort of takes a hit, and so the thing that women have to then do is actively project that warmth again and sort of, you know, double back. And the old line about Ginger Rogers and Fred Astaire rings true here. She had to do everything Fred Astaire had to do except in high heels and backwards. And that's kind of a way to think about the challenge here and how there is a bit of a double standard for women in the workplace.
And, you know, that leads me to maybe my last question here, Matt, is that we are in the workplace. We're trying to be strong. When you feel yourself projecting that the power me, how do you remind yourself at that point in time to also, I guess it's all in your book. It's, you know, maybe relaxing your hands or relaxing your shoulders and just thinking about warmth.
Yeah, on the physical side, that's right. And then the other thing to remind yourself is that if you are projecting your strength on behalf of the people who you care about in that setting, even in the workplace setting, if it's, in other words, on behalf of the team, on behalf of the organization, then that can play well. It's when it seems like it's just your own, sort of to further your own ambition, that it can be a little more of a tricky situation. But when it's strength on behalf of warmth for the team, for the group, that is a much surer place in which you can sort of flex those muscles and feel confident that it's going to go in a better direction.
Matt, what's your favorite example in the book of somebody that has blended a proper balance of strength and warmth, and how did that manifest?
Well, the example we give early in the book there is that of Dr. Martin Luther King, and how he really manifested both strength and warmth. And really, he was using his power on behalf of people that he cared deeply about. And so it's, again, to this example we were just talking about, it's strength on behalf of other folks. And that's the most powerful thing that, you know, when we see people like that, we admire them, and we want them to be leaders, and we rest well knowing that they have our interests at heart. That was one that really stood out for us both.
If only we could all speak so passionately and with so much warmth and strength about people we're speaking on behalf of.
It is rare air.
Yeah. And finally, Matt, I wanted to say this instance that I've seen. I have kids, and I would call this the mother bear. If you've seen these women who are, you know, typically maybe they're stay-at-home moms, but when it comes time to protecting their children or advocating for their children, I see them go into, I call it mother bear mode, where they are ruthless and they are so strong, but it's again in this, they're playing this role where they're not usually having to be strong. They're just being warm with their kids. And it's this interplay that doesn't often work.
Yeah. Well, you know, this thing of protecting your children, though, is one of these situations where when women show strength in that setting, it's absolutely fine. You know, there's none of this gender dynamic stuff that we were talking about earlier, where there's, you know, this sort of penalty to the warmth. It's completely expected, and we all see it, and we recognize it for what it is. And that's a very, you know, it's funny, you say mama and bear, that's warm and strong right there.
Right.
And so these things are very much part of how parenting happens and how teaching happens. These dynamics are really intertwined into so many facets of our everyday life.
So, Matt, my final question is, I asked you about your favorite example of where blending strength and warmth worked and how it manifests itself. What about an example of the attempt to blend that did not work?
The attempt to blend that did not work. Well, you know, I think we see this all the time. I don't know that I see this with people who are trying to blend it, but, you know, one of the sort of funny caricatures of this is a guy who's all strength, and we all, you know who he is from reality TV from the last several years, and that's Donald Trump. And, you know, he's made his tagline, "You're fired," which is about the most, you know, sort of absurdly strong thing you could want people to associate with you. And so I think he's an example of a guy who, while on the one hand he's clearly got admirers, people who enjoy him, so he must be exuding some odd sort of warmth to them as an entertainer in this context. He's made some very unusual choices about how to be a compelling person when he's chosen, you know, such a parody of all strength to do it. But maybe it's working for him. I don't know.
Oh, and we just lost, the call came in, we just lost Donald Trump as one of our sponsors of The Mountain Life.
Oh, that's a good example to take through your day as you think about it. Well, the book is Compelling People. It's the hidden qualities that make us influential. And our guest is Matthew Kohut. He's co-written this book along with John Neffinger. And Matt, it's been a pleasure talking with you. Thanks so much for your time.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
And that again was Matt Kohut, author of Compelling People, or co-author, I should say. And wow, that was an interesting book. Didn't you find that to be, Tim?
Yeah, I like that trade-off between strength and warmth. It's a good theme.
Yeah, very good. So stay with us. We'll be back. Our next guest is Chris Arp. He's the author, or shall I say editor, of the book Up Your Score, ACT. It's the underground guide on how to outsmart the ACT. I like that, too. That's helpful for all these sophomores, juniors, and seniors going off or starting to take that.
What did you take when you were preparing for college? SAT or ACT?
I just took the ACT.
I did, too. I just took the ACT, but I was in the Midwest, and it was kind of a Midwestern thing.
Right. And I was in Idaho. Maybe it was an Idaho thing, too. But, yeah, it's kind of, you know, for a while it was the SAT. Now it seems like it's trending back, well, towards both, but a lot of weight is placed on the ACT. I think that's what Chris will tell us, and we'll be right back to hear from him. This is The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. Stay with us.
This is Ann from Park City Nursery and the Park City Tree Ranch. We're proud to have helped KPCW grow and flourish since 1983. Park City Nursery and the Tree Ranch have a variety of products to help your yard and garden do the same. Flowers, seeds, shrubs, and trees, water-wise sprinklers, consulting, and landscaping. We know what grows at parkcitynursery.com.
Hi, this is Steve Roney with Prudential Utah Real Estate, a proud supporter of KPCW. With more than 100 sales associates and 14 gallery or ski-in offices in Park City, Prudential Utah can help you with your residential or commercial real estate needs. More information at pru-utah.com or with the Prudential Utah mobile search app.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak here with Tim Henney. Well, be prepared. Be very prepared. That's what our next guest says regarding the ACT test. For all you high school sophomores, juniors, and seniors who are launching into that, or probably right in the middle of it right now, the big day is almost here. And when you walk into the ACT testing hall, will you be quaking or will you be calm, cool, and ready? So test prep guru Chris Arp, along with three students who each scored a perfect 36, up your score ACT. It's the underground guide filled with attitude, encouragement, and a wicked sense of humor. And now joining us to talk about this new book is Chris Arp. Chris Arp, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thanks. You know, maybe we should just get started by talking about the differences between the ACT and the SAT. I think it was different when we were of that age, and it's kind of morphing now. Where do we stand with those two tests?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, I work in New York City. I work with a company called Veritas Tutors. And out here, the SAT was always king. But a couple years ago, I noticed that some of my students were looking at the ACT. And when they looked at the ACT, they switched over to the ACT, and they liked the ACT. And so I think that there are two really important things for anybody who's entering into the ACT, for parents who are less familiar with it, or even kids who are less familiar with it. One is that the questions on the ACT feel and look a lot more like the homework you've been doing in high school. If you look at a math question on the SAT, for example, it's going to take some work and some figuring before you even know what mathematical concept to use in order to solve the problem. The ACT is different. The ACT looks more like the homework sheets that you've been doing forever, and so I think that that draws a lot of kids. It's more straightforward. But perhaps a more important difference, and this is something that even people who know the ACT don't necessarily know this, is that after you take the ACT, after you get your score, you can choose whether you send that score to schools or not. That's not true of the SAT. When you take the SAT, your score is out there. Colleges can choose whether or not they look at it. But having that power to choose whether to send the score makes taking the test feel different. If you're taking the test and it doesn't go well or you don't get quite the score that you wanted, you can choose to take a mulligan and not send it. And that's a really big difference.
Huge difference. So are the ACT and SAT testing different things?
Yeah, absolutely. The ACT has a science section. A lot of kids worry about this section. They think that they have to review all of chemistry and biology and physics, but that's not true at all. The science section is really testing graphs, how well you can look at charts, how you can analyze experiments. It's much more of a reasoning test. The ACT is also, it doesn't explicitly test vocabulary like the SAT does, and that's nice, but it does get pretty heavy-duty into punctuation and grammar, which are not two of the most popular subjects these days for teenagers. One thing that we had to do in my book, Up Your Score, was we had to make that chapter especially funny. We want the whole book to be funny, readable, engaging. You know, we want kids to want to read it, but especially when we're telling them about comma splices. So we embedded all of those rules within jokes, within stories, within anecdotes, so that they can tolerate and more easily absorb lessons about things like punctuation and grammar.
Chris, why do we have two tests that are on kind of different tracks, the ACT that's more like high school homework and the SAT that's more like reasoning? Don't we want our college applicants to know how to reason, and don't we want them to know how to do grammar and punctuation? Why don't we have some blended test that has kind of made both of these obsolete?
That's a great question, and I think, you know, in an ideal world we will, but the truth of the matter is, both tests are testing reasoning and knowledge. This division that one tests only one and one tests the other, I don't think is quite accurate. And one of the things that I really like about the ACT in particular is that absolutely you have to use reasoning, especially in things like the reading test, in some of the harder math questions. but they're not being tricky. They're not being, you know, they're not in any way hiding what they want you to know. They're both requiring skills that are going to be really important in college. So one thing that we talk about in the book is, for example, in the reading chapter, we talk about actively engaging with what you're reading. We call it the five steps of lean forward reading. And one of those is treating reading a book like being in a conversation, like you're talking with the writer, so that when they say something, you react to it. You treat it as if you were kind of sitting across the table from them having coffee. And these are the kinds of skills that we hope kids will take with them into college and even beyond.
So, Chris, are you teaching in your book, you're not just teaching test taking then, you're teaching developing a broader repertoire of skills just for general thinking?
Well, I've been a tutor for a number of years. I've been doing test prep for a number of years, and I've long thought that test prep was bigger than people think it is. People think it's kind of learning a trick to help you move more quickly through a test or teaching you how to do fractions. But in truth, what we're really talking about is how to manage anxiety. How to manage anxiety both before the test and during the test, how to deal with an upcoming stressful event, how to map out a plan. These are life skills. And so in the book, there's an entire chapter for anxiety. There's a separate chapter for how to organize your brain while you're taking the test. There's a separate chapter for what to do the night before the test so that you're in the best state of mind possible when you take it. I think that these things are as essential as learning the content. Two students can go take the ACT who have the same level of knowledge, who know the same rules for punctuation and grammar, who know the same mathematical concepts. But if one of them knows how to move through the test with more agility, if one of them has worked on their endurance over time, if one of them has planned out their study habit, they're going to score much higher. This stuff is really important, and these kinds of skills carry over through college and beyond.
So, Chris, that's the part about sort of the trick of taking the test is being properly prepared, managing your anxiety, being able to move quickly through the test. And so that is kind of a trick. I mean, if you can dial that in, you're going to have a distinct advantage if your knowledge is at the same level with some other student.
Absolutely. And I think a thing to consider is that there are different strategies for different kinds of kids. So when I wrote this book, I got in touch with three kids, Ava Chen, Zach Swofford, and John Fish. And these are kids who are all heading off to college in September. And these kids had just taken the ACT, and they'd all gotten perfect scores. So I wrote it with them, and we sat down, and we wrote it together. And we realized that there were certain strategies for certain kids, different strategies for other kids. You know, one kid can have a whole wide range of different anxiety reactions, and there are different strategies to handle those. And that's why we gave so much time and space to that element of test taking. And I also think that that's what made this book, you know, less of kind of what makes it different is that it's more like walking into a room with a bunch of other teenagers who've just been through it, and they just recently went through it, and they know exactly what it's like to go through it. And so they're talking in a kind of peer-to-peer way with the reader.
Chris, I'm curious. You said you worked with three students, and they all got perfect scores. How many kids get perfect scores on either the SAT or the ACT as a percentage?
An infinitesimal amount. It's a surprisingly small number of kids. It's a real accomplishment.
So I wanted to ask you then, do you believe that there are good test takers and bad test takers?
I think that kids come to a test with different levels of preparedness, but more importantly, I think they come with different levels of self-understanding about how they learn. So some kids go in and they think, oh, I can just, you know, walk in and take it. And those kids need to kind of wake up and smell the coffee that they're going to have to do more work. Other kids might think that they need to hyper-prepare or prepare in a way that's not quite as helpful. What's important going in is less, you know, am I a good test taker or a bad test taker, as developing some self-awareness about your learning style and about your test-taking style. And that's a thing which we talk about a lot in the book. Now, we talk about all this, makes it sound kind of serious. We're also trying to do it in a way that's fun and funny and engaging, because we understand that nobody's going to read a book that they don't enjoy reading, or even if they do force themselves to read it, they're not really going to take much from it unless they're enjoying reading it. So while we're imparting these lessons, we're doing it in the forms of, you know, plays, skits, jokes. We have fables in there. We have some Zen koans. We have some recipes. It's full of cartoons. So it's all a way of kind of absorbing this in a way which is enjoyable.
And that was the first thing that I noted about your book when I opened it. Immediately it was fun and funny, and I said, oh, wow, this is written for the kids.
Right, exactly. I mean, I think one of the worst injustices to kids who are going into their junior or senior year taking this test is that most test prep books are written in the same language and style as the tests themselves, which is dry and boring and unpleasant. Okay. And so the idea of preparation becomes as onerous, which is a great vocab word for the test,
absolutely,
as actually taking the test.
Chris, I remember when I was in college, or even before college, part of the story, and maybe it was myth behind whether it was SAT, ACT, or LSAT, or MCATs, was always that, you know, they have compiled a history of all tests ever taken, and they know every question that is going to be asked. And if you simply review that compendium of knowledge, you will do really well.
Well, I think that seems like it's a bit of an exaggeration, but what is true is that the more practice tests you take, the more prepared you are for the test. And that's especially true for the ACT, because while the questions might not be the same as tests you've seen, and while they might not be recycling questions, they're certainly asking the same kinds of questions. This is especially true for a section like the science section, where there's only so many graphs in the world that, you know, graph types. And so if you take a bunch of practice tests, and one thing we recommend in the book is that kids go out and pick up the real guide to the ACT, which is put out by the ACT company, and it's got real ACT tests. And if you work through those, and we have plans that tell kids how to work through them and how to use their practice tests, then they are going to feel much more familiar when they sit down to that test.
Our guest is Chris Arp. He is the editor and, well, writer, along with three kids who scored perfect scores on the ACT. The book is Up Your Score, ACT. It's the underground guide and the secret weapon for total ACT domination. I like that. Even your tagline makes it sound fun.
Uh-huh. Well,
kids like to dominate.
They should see it as empowerment.
Right. And also what I like, you have a 3-month kind of schedule, a 3-week schedule, and a 3-day schedule.
Well, we know that kids are coming to the book with different situations. I'm hoping that every kid will listen to this interview, or their parents will, and they'll run out and get the book in August and get started. You know, that's my dream, and if that's true, then we have a plan for them. We have this 3-month plan that tells them how to work through the book, which chapters to read when to take practice tests, what to do with those practice tests, how to think about those practice tests. But let's say a kid has left it off a little bit, as some kids might, and they only have a month left. Then they have a 3-week plan. And so in the 3-week plan, it's a bit faster, but we still tell them what to do on which day, so they have a schedule of how to do it. And then for the kids who are really excellent at procrastinating, those kind of grade A putter offers, we have a 3-day plan, and it's just this crash course through the book, through the practice test, and then they take it. But I got to say, after they take it, we do recommend they sign up to take it again.
That's right. Well, that leads to my next question. I actually have a child who's going off to college who just went through all of this, and he took it, I think, 2 or 3 times. It's been interesting to hear him talk to his younger brother, who will be a sophomore this year, you know, giving him tips on what he should do to ace the ACT. And, you know, one of the things he said is you got to take it as many times as possible. Do you have a prescribed number of times that you think that you see kids really succeeding on when they take it that number?
Sure, sure. Well, in my experience, kids who take it multiple times do better. They do better the more they take it, up to a limit. So the first time a kid takes it, they're dealing with the anxiety of going to the center, of sitting down, of working through it for the first time. It's early in the morning. They've never done this before. That tends not to be their best score. So, you know, I've been teaching the ACT for years and years, and I like it when I like my kids to take it, certainly at least twice. Now, you're allowed to take it 12 times, and to my mind, a year full of 12 ACT tests just doesn't sound very pleasant. So I think that, you know, you don't want to be taking it, hopefully, more than 4 or 5 times over the course of your junior and beginning of senior year.
Oh, so you, as a sophomore, you don't recommend taking it then?
Some kids do take it towards the end of their sophomore year, and that's fine. I think that they can totally wait until their junior year before they really start buckling down and studying. One of the great things about the ACT, like I said, is that you don't have to send your score. So really, they can start as early as they want just to get a taste for it. But in terms of really starting to study on a daily basis or a weekly basis, I think starting in your sophomore year risks burnout.
And Chris, you've referred to it twice. You don't have to send your score. Do you take the test, see your result, and then decide to send your score?
That's exactly right.
Okay, well, that's
exactly right.
That's pretty significant.
And a lot of people don't know that, and I think it's a crucial difference between the tests.
Right. And let's say you have somebody who's a really proficient critical thinker, but they might not have all the high school knowledge wired. Is there one test versus the other that you would recommend for somebody proficient and strong in critical thinking?
Sure, sure. I mean, the classic philosophy would be to send them to the SAT. What I would have them do is I would have them take both tests. The tests feel very different. There are other differences. The ACT gives you less time per question. It's a faster test. The SAT varies its sections. The ACT does not. I would have that student and any student sit down, look at both, and choose. Because colleges, every college in America, gives each score equal weight. And once they've picked which test feels better, the actual process of sitting down and taking it, that's the test that they should stick with, and that's the test that they should really study for.
Now, did you also write a book upping your SAT scores?
No, the Up Your Score SAT is by a different author.
Okay.
But it's the same series. And it was the same idea, which was that both of these tests are these gigantic, onerous beasts, and kids did not have a book that spoke their language, that was engaging, that was fun. They didn't have a book that paid as much attention to things like anxiety, things like how to plan for the test, ways to think while you're moving through the test. That's really missing from the market for preparation for the ACT. And so that's why we felt that now that the ACT is more popular than the SAT, it calls out for this book as well.
And can you just walk us through that progression of the ascendancy of ACT? Because I know when I was in high school, it was how you described it in your introduction. It was kind of a Midwestern thing.
Yeah,
and,
absolutely.
And now
yeah.
You're saying it's more popular than the SAT.
Exactly right. I mean, I think that, for one thing, it was made the mandatory test in Illinois, Michigan, Colorado. So that really upped its popularity, obviously. But the other thing that happened was that on the coast, kids became aware of the ACT. I think a lot of that happened because colleges started accepting it. And when they looked at the ACT, a lot of kids said, this feels more familiar, this feels more comfortable, and switched over to it. But I think that for parents who have never seen the SAT or who don't have as much familiarity with the ACT, it's important to know that it is a very different test. It's not, you can't just do kind of a catch-all, you know, study for it. They are different. And so this book is really necessary to fill that void of having, you know, a readable, fun, exciting book that will give them some of the extra skills that they need.
So you're filling the void, you're addressing a need, but you also, you've gravitated yourself toward the ACT. It's what you tutor in, and you have extensive knowledge of the ACT.
Yeah,
so
and I tutor both tests, actually.
And what drew you to, I mean, it seems like I'm hearing you have a preference for the ACT. I might be misunderstanding that. But what are you basing, if there is a preference for ACT, on?
Well, I wouldn't say that I have a preference for the ACT. I think that, I teach in New York, and most kids here hadn't even heard of the ACT, and there's some weird myths about it. One is that it's easier, which is not true. The other is that some kids think it's more boring, which is not true. So I think my job is to dispel a lot of myths about the ACT. I think that both the ACT and the SAT do a fine job of what they're designed to do, which is give a prognosis for how the kid will perform in college. And I tutor both. But my encounter with the ACT was through my students. You know, I started off SAT only because that was the only test in New York. But as my students started asking about the ACT, started looking towards the ACT, that's when that became my job.
Okay. Chris, your book or an ACT prep class?
Well, so I teach ACT prep classes.
Right.
I'm a tutor. I teach classes and individual students in the tri-state area. And my colleagues at Veritas Tutors and Test Prep, we all put a lot of our wisdom and knowledge in this book. So a lot of each chapter has these sidebars called tutor tips, which tell you exactly what tutors do in order to teach this particular subject or sometimes even this particular content area. So a lot of what we do as tutors is in the book. And I have to say, at $13.95, it's a little cheaper than a course.
That's right. Well, Chris Arp, thanks so much for your time today. The book is Up Your Score ACT. It's the underground guide, how to outsmart the ACT by this top tutor, Chris Arp, and then three kids who got perfect scores. And I should mention that Zach Swafford's going off to Stanford, Ava Chen's going to MIT, and John Fish, the University of Kentucky. I'm sure it was fun to write the book along with them.
Oh, it was.
Very good. Thanks so much for your time,
Chris.
Thanks,
Lynn. Thanks, Tim.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And this is The Mountain Life, healthy living in the Wasatch. We'll be right back.
Hi, this is Gordon Raymond at Republic Services, a proud sponsor of KPCW. Gray is for garbage. Those four words will help you remember the current waste and recycling program. Your blue or brown bin is for recyclables. Gray is for garbage. AlliedWasteUtah.com/Summit County.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided by Longreimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, LRW-LAW.com. Park City Nursery. For 30 years, we know what grows. ParkCityNursery.com. VaultHomeLoans.com. Purchase and refinance mortgages. Conventional FHA and VA. 801-201-3484. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and listeners like you.
Hi, I'm Amy Roberts with Park City Medical Center, a nonprofit community hospital. Have you ever wondered how many calories you burn while you sleep, or how much your organs weigh, or how you can lower your healthcare costs and prevent many diseases? Live Well Center at Park City Medical Center has those answers and more. Whether you're hoping to lose weight or gain a competitive edge, Live Well Center can help. Make an appointment today for a healthy lifestyle evaluation, now covered by most insurance companies. Visit livewellcenter.org/PC for more information.
Join KPCW every weekday morning from 6 to 8 a.m. for the latest news in town and around the world. Trusted news anchor Leslie Thatcher delivers local news as well as broadcasts of NPR News, Marketplace, and national stories. Morning Edition with Leslie Thatcher is brought to you by Promontory the Ranch Club, Nexus IT, and Jance Mountain Outfitters.
Thanks for listening to The Mountain Life, healthy living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak here with Tim Henney. Want to thank our guest today, Matt Kohut. He wrote the book Compelling People, and also Chris Arp with that book Up Your Score ACT, The Underground Guide. And just makes me want to take the ACT again.
Oh, yeah.
Not really.
May I please?
Yeah, exactly.
Once was enough.
That's right. Let's thank our underwriters.
Okay. Utah Olympic Legacy Foundation, Utah Prudential Real Estate, Grand Valley Bank Frontier Branch, Park Meadows Country Club, Stein Erickson Lodge and Spa, Park City Clinic, and San Francisco Design.
Well said, Tim.
Thank you, Lynn.
And we also want to talk a little bit about next week. As most of our listeners know, it's the KPCW Fall Fund Drive, Pledge Drive. And most of our listeners are probably being interested in athletic sorts of endeavors. We might have some competitive sorts out there, and we're competitive. And we have this ongoing competition with...
Well, why do you think we're competitive?
I don't know.
You've heard that somewhere.
I heard we are. No, we are because we want to beat Fun Friday. That's the bottom line here. That's what I'm getting at.
That is the bottom line.
And beating Fun Friday means
is what it's all about.
We need to have our listeners who love the mountain life to call in during next week's show on Wednesday from 9 to 10. That's what we want.
So check your Facebook post because KPCW, The Mountain Life, will be bombarding you with reminders to call
in. Bombarding.
Possibly bombarding. Spamming.
But it's always fun anyway. The pledge drive is fun. We'll have a great guest on, and then we'll be doing the pledge drive, and that's when we want your calls of support. So
we need the calls next Wednesday because Fun Friday has nipped us, the last two fundraisers, right at the bell.
Really?
Yep.
No, we beat them the one before last.
Maybe.
Handily. We did. And we won. So it's close. It's close. All right. You're listening to KPCW 91.9 FM Park City. And stay tuned now for news followed by music. Thanks for listening.
Join KPCW every Sunday morning at 9 for The Splendid Table, sponsored by River Horse on Main.